Anyone who says that these are all going to be taxes, that's just not accurate.
This is a tax. Alaskans react to the Supreme Court ruling on the health care law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 28th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, now that the state needs to start implementing the law, can it do it on time?
The timeline is pretty aggressive, even if you're one of the leaning forward states that embraced the health plan from the very start.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Alaska's members of Congress are reacting with mixed emotions to the Supreme Court's ruling largely upholding the health care overhaul bill. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the breakdown is along expected political lines.
Here's a pretty straightforward illustration of how the two political parties are spinning the ruling.
Anyone who says that these are all going to be taxes, that's just not accurate.
This is a tax.
Those are U.S. Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski, the former a Democrat, the latter a Republican. The two tend to vote alike, but on issues as seismic as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, as it's officially known, they diverge. The sticking point Thursday at the court and in the halls of the Capitol was what it has been for the past couple of years, the requirement everyone purchase insurance or face a fee if they don't, the so-called individual mandate. Senator Begich contends the fee, or tax, to use Chief Justice John Roberts' term, will only apply to a small portion of the population, those who can afford insurance but choose not to buy it. Everyone else, he says, is covered through subsidies and government programs.
No more freeloading. Now, personal responsibility. You have to take care of your health care. You have to take care of your coverage. And if you're not getting coverage because you just don't want to pay for it, you're not getting a free ride anymore.
For her part, Senator Murkowski says the American public was duped by President Obama and congressional Democrats into supporting the individual mandate.
In not understanding that what this really is this is a tax on you. And you've got no choice. You've got no choice but to pay that tax. Because if you fail to do so, the IRS is going to come and talk to you.
The court struck down a provision requiring states to expand Medicaid rolls, but other elements, less partisan ones, remain intact. Parents can include children up to 26 on their plans, a popular element of the law that the White House estimates 9,000 people in Alaska have benefited from. Congressional Republicans say they will push to repeal the bill. When and if that will ever happen remains unclear. Representative Don Young says the House will vote yet again to repeal the health care bill. It's already passed a bill doing so that went nowhere in the Senate.
Well, the point is, very frankly, to show that we're not satisfied with the decision of the court. I would have accepted the fact that if they just threw out that one provision.
Young says if the court had thrown out the entire plan, which he would have preferred, it would have lent some gusto to the move to repeal the bill. But he says it did not, and that makes the repeal effort harder. Senator Murkowski says there will be an effort to repeal the bill in the Senate, but she did not indicate when or who would occupy the White House at the time of the vote. Repeal the bill has become a sort of rallying cry for conservatives, and the Chief Justice used another in his majority opinion, tax. Expect to hear a lot more of both of those toxic terms in the run-up to November's elections. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Governor Sean Parnell says Alaskans stand to lose more freedom and pay more taxes with today's Supreme Court ruling, largely upholding the federal health care overall. Alaska was one of 26 states suing to overturn the Affordable Care Act. At a news conference this afternoon, Parnell said the state may have lost the battle, but isn't going to stop fighting.
This ruling should rally Americans to action and galvanize support for congressional change.
Parnell says the law is costly for Americans and unworkable. He says he hasn't read the full decision and is still working to understand the scope of the decision and how it will impact Alaskans.
As I think about the decision today, I basically have come back to, we're going to get good information once we've reviewed the decision. And I will work to shift back to the federal government those costs it is imposing on our citizens.
The Supreme Court threw out the part of the law that essentially forces states to dramatically increase the number of people eligible for Medicaid. 135,000 Alaskans now use Medicaid. Under the law, the federal government will fully fund expanding the program in the first few years and mostly fund it after that. Parnell won't say whether the state will opt out of the Medicaid expansion, but he says he will consider it. He's worried about the state's share in paying for it.
Over time, that 10% comes back to the state, so another $30 million a year roughly. But what's to say that that will not grow?
The state has taken one step towards setting up one of the law's requirements, a health insurance exchange to help residents purchase affordable insurance. The state hired the Boston-based company Public Consulting Group to study options for the exchange. That report is due out in the next few days. It will include a roadmap with three options for how the state can set up an exchange: a state-based exchange, a federal-state partnership, or a federally facilitated exchange. Health and Social Services Commissioner Bill Stroyer says the big challenge with the law will be meeting deadlines for implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
The timeline is pretty aggressive, even if you're one of the leaning forward states that embrace the health plan from the very start.
State officials estimate there are about 125,000 uninsured people in Alaska. One of the requirements of the Affordable Care Act is that exchanges run by the states be sustainable by 2015. While the Parnell administration is strongly condemning the Supreme Court's health care ruling, some Alaskans had a different take when they heard the news. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Vicki Penwell was asleep at 6:15 this morning when a series of texts from her mom started coming in. "Are you up?" her mom wrote. "Have you seen the news?" she continued. "Upheld in full."
We started the cheer at that point.
Penwell from Nabesna is a volunteer with the National Patient Advocate Foundation, an organization that pushed for the Affordable Care Act. She says Alaskans may not be seeing the benefits of the law yet, but they will.
This is just going to allow thousands of uninsured and underinsured Alaskans to get healthcare coverage that will allow them to be able to afford even just routine preventative screenings.
Penwell's son was born with cystic fibrosis, and she says since he turned 18, he hasn't been able to get health insurance. She says that means he can't get the preventative treatments necessary to keep him from having to make frequent trips to the hospital. Getting health insurance for more Alaskans has been a big priority for Democratic Senator Hollis French from Anchorage. French says the law is good for Alaskans.
Well, it really does help those folks who are sick. It will help them find policies because you can't be denied coverage due to a pre-existing condition. It will help the 115,000 people who would like to buy a policy but can't afford one find a private policy that works to their benefit.
The law calls on states to develop health insurance exchanges to make it easy for consumers to find good health care plans. Alaska has taken minimal steps towards implementing an exchange. The state is supposed to have one up and running by 2014, but French isn't worried about that timeline.
You know, I think most states are behind the curve on this, and we're not alone. It'll be a project to get an exchange up and running in time, but I think it's achievable.
Hospitals across the state have been quietly implementing various aspects of the healthcare law, and Karen Perdue, president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, says she was relieved by today's Supreme Court ruling.
We have been feeling like the train has already left the station in regard to a lot of the efforts in the law, so we're kind of happy to see that there's some settling, at least on the court's part.
Purdue says the federal government has been issuing new regulations almost monthly since the health care law passed.
So in our industry, which is really comprised of thousands of moving parts, there has been a tremendous amount of activity.
Purdue estimates the law will enable 70,000 more Alaskans to buy health insurance, but 30,000 of those people would be eligible for free insurance through an expansion of the Medicaid program. The Supreme Court struck down the part of the law that forces states to participate in the expansion, but the federal government will fund the Medicaid expansion at 100% for the first 3 years and 90% after that. And Purdue points out that's a very good deal.
You know, these individuals would be some of our most chronically ill people that are between the ages of 21 and 65, and they don't have coverage. They're using the healthcare system extremely expensively in our emergency rooms, and probably their care could be managed in a much more effective way.
The state hasn't said yet whether it will opt out of the Medicaid expansion in the health care law. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, anglers react to the closure of the popular Ship Creek fishery in downtown Anchorage.
Yeah, this year's been slow, you know, because of the water and stuff, but yeah, you can't beat it. But I just had one on just a few minutes ago and I lost them.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Congress is set to vote on a transportation bill by the end of the week. The plan will fund construction projects for the next 2 years, and both parties are touting it as a major jobs package. The plan gives the Alaska Railroad $31 million, which is less than it's received in the past, though things could have been much worse. An earlier version of the transportation bill that passed the Senate zeroed out funding for the railroad. Representative Don Young says the money has been reinstated, and the railroad should be pleased.
We need to look upon this railroad as one of the best things that's happened to the state, and we need to keep expanding it, making it more economical, and making it a service tool. You can only develop your resources and your manufacturing base if you have rail available.
The bill also maintains funding for the Alaska Marine Highway and tribal roads. It's expected to pass on Friday. As expected, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar today signed off on a 5-year plan for federal offshore oil and gas leasing that includes more sales off the shores of Alaska, despite heavy pressure by environmental groups who have been campaigning against any more sales in the Arctic Ocean. APRN Steve Heimel tells us more.
Secretary Salazar, just back from an oil minister's gathering in Norway, said all the Arctic nations are planning to step up energy exploration off their northern shores. Norway has announced plans for lease sales next year. Salazar and Bureau of Ocean Energy Management head Tommy Boudreau did make some changes in the draft plan they released last November. Sales in the Chukchi Sea and Cook Inlet are still scheduled for 2016, but a sale in the Beaufort Sea was moved back 2 years from 2015 to 2017. Boudreau said the area needs more study, and the additional time will be used for what he called targeting the sales. At a news conference today, he pointed to a map that showed where the oil is thought to be and also where subsistence activities take place.
You can see from the Beaufort map, there's a lot of overlap between where the hydrocarbon potential is and where the environmentally sensitive areas and subsistence use areas are. And so we want to give ourselves enough time to have a very rigorous process towards defining what areas may be appropriate in the Beaufort for targeted leasing.
The official said they were looking at imposing restrictions on lease tracts where there could be conflicts, but also at simply removing them from the sale. That's what they decided to do for an area directly north of Barrow, for instance. Along with targeting, the other word they were using was deconflict. Salazar says research on subsistence use and wildlife habitat has intensified, and they're building up information that will be used to shape the sale areas.
But we want to make sure that the lease sales are being held in those areas where we have deconflicted the uses before those leases are offered.
So far, there has only been one lease sale in the Chukchi Sea. In 2008, the vast swath of it was made available, and the industry put down a record $2.6 billion for the right to explore there. Scientists soon learned that wildlife are heavily dependent on some of the areas that were leased, particularly in the northern end at Hannah Shoal, the last place where sea ice melts off in the summer. Boudreaux said the next time they'll know better as they design the sale scheduled for 2016.
We have ongoing studies with respect to the Hannah Shoal area. Those studies will inform decision-making about the configuration of any targeted lease sale in the Chukchi.
The lease sale schedule is far more than what environmental groups wanted, and they quickly fired off press releases accusing the Obama administration of selling leases too close to the habitat of endangered species, such as the polar bear, walrus, and a number of different kinds of birds. The five-year plan includes one sale in Cook Inlet, where an earlier sale drew no bids at all. But Boudreaux said the industry is more interested now. But the inlet has endangered species as well, and he said the Bureau will have to take that into account.
There may be additional mitigation to address endangered species like the beluga there, but we have to do the analysis and let the analysis be our guide on that.
The bulk of the plan's 15 lease sales are in the Gulf of Mexico, which is now the source of one quarter of the nation's domestic production. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Marine debris is nothing new, and a NOAA crew found little of note in last week's survey of outside panhandle beaches. Beginning in Ketchikan, five scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration hit 36 sites looking for debris from the March 2011 tsunami that hit Japan. They mostly found common stuff, including a lot of styrofoam, but large oval black, yellow, and orange buoys turned up on 26 out of 36 beaches.
They were pretty ubiquitous throughout our survey area.
Lead scientist Jacek Maselko describes them as molded hard plastic with rings on either end. Some had English, some had Japanese writing. Jeep Rice of NOAA's Auk Bay Lab says they're not fishing gear and likely are part of the Japanese fish farming industry.
Some of the aquaculture farms with lots of nets and oysters and other things attached were swept up in the tsunami, and these would be the buoys that, you know, survived, so to speak.
Rice says the buoys were about 2 feet in diameter and 3.5 to 4 feet tall and could support a lot of weight.
These would be flying really high in the water, so to speak, so they're going to be easily taken by the wind and pushed by the wind further than, say, the water currents would take them. So when there's a conflict of a current versus air or current versus wind, these are going to be taken by the wind.
The scientists also found a number of 5-gallon jugs that appear to contain some type of waste oil. Some were empty, others broken up, and some still had liquid contents. With no labels for a clue, Rice says the NOAA lab is trying to figure out what the substance is.
One of them looks kind of soapy-like. I don't know if that's maybe kitchen grease and soap or oil, or did it come out of a transmission, or we don't know.
While some notable things have washed up in the Pacific Northwest from the Japanese tsunami, such as a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, a dock, and the so-called ghost ship sunk in April by the Coast Guard, Maselko says most of the stuff the NOAA scientists cataloged may have been dumped in the ocean or found its way there years ago.
We don't know. Even finding a ball with a name on it, you know, you never know if somebody just didn't lose it playing beach volleyball in years past. That's where the tough part of proof comes in.
The scientists will next survey beaches in the Yakutat area. Maselko says he intends to canvass as much of the Gulf of Alaska shoreline as possible this summer, looking for tsunami debris.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
Anchorage's Urban Ship Creek fishery is the latest Chinook salmon fishery to be closed by the State Fish and Game Department, effective July 1st. The move comes as a surprise since the fishery is a stocked one. Anglers on Ship Creek today reacted to the emergency closure, including Anchorage fisherman Jeff Banbury.
Oh, I thought they're just hatchery fish anyway, ain't they?
That's
But I guess everywhere else is closed, so why won't this place be closed, I guess, huh?
Banbury has fished the creek for 7 years.
Yeah, this year's been slow, you know, because of the water and stuff, but yeah, you can't beat it. But I just had one on just a few minutes ago and I lost him.
Dan Bosch is the area management biologist for the fishery. Bosch says the closure is not a precedent-setting move because Ship Creek was shut down early in 2009. He says he has been unable to do a stream survey this year since he has yet to see a king salmon in the creek because the water in the creek is unusually high and muddy due to snow melt runoff. State biologists say by now 40% of the Chinook should have escaped to spawn, but due to the uncertainty of the escapement data and the poor performance of other Cook Inlet Chinook salmon runs, both wild and hatchery, they're taking a precautionary step in closing the fishery. Ship Creek will reopen to coho salmon fishing in mid-July. Over 30 years ago, the Sitka River watershed on Chichagof Island was logged, damaging the local salmon habitat. Now the U.S. Forest Service is partnering with environmental groups to restore the river, and they say the project is a perfect example of broader changes taking place on the Tongass. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz took a walk in the water and brings us this report.
If the minnow trap is sticking straight out and it's bobbing on top of the water, it's not going to do any good. What we're looking for...
We're about 35 air miles north of Sitka, along an old logging road in the Tongass National Forest. Forest Service staff and volunteers with the Sitka Conservation Society are setting fish traps in the Sitka River. They have just a couple hours to move hundreds of fish out of a 300-yard stretch of stream, and they're taking bets on how many fish they'll catch.
222.
400.
Just about 500.
304.
In this side channel of the Sitka River, the water is about 15 feet across, and it's nearly up to my knees. But in just a few hours, there will be hardly any water here at all. That's because contractors with the U.S. Forest Service are creating a temporary dam upstream, which will redirect the water of the Sitka and allow this stream bed to dry up. And that's why they're trapping fish, mostly coho salmon fry, to move them downstream.
Fish!
Once it's dry, the contractors will begin work that they hope will restore this stretch of river to usable salmon habitat, repairing damage that was caused by logging over 30 years ago.
This logging road is not prime salmon habitat. It's wide.
That's Perry Edwards, ecosystem staff for the Forest Service's Sitka Ranger District. He's also on our board here at KCAW. This area was logged in the 1970s and again in the 1990s. The Forest Service clear-cut about 2,800 acres. That's about a quarter of the Sitka River watershed. And they built about 30 miles of road. A section of that road is now part of the problem. It was built so close to the river that the water jumped its banks and now runs down the road instead.
Area where it's shallow, and in the summertime, if we have a low flow, it could dry out enough to actually dry up to where the fish can't make it through and they're gonna die. In the wintertime, it's so shallow that it's gonna freeze solid. Again, it's gonna kill these fish.
The road isn't the only problem. In the 1970s, loggers cut right down to the stream's edge, a practice that's now illegal. That meant there were no big, old-growth trees to hold the banks in place. And it meant there were no big trees to fall across the river and create the deeper pools of slower water that salmon need to rest on their journey upstream, and to hide from predators or build their nest. And it's Forest Service hydrologist Martin Becker's job to fix that.
Approximately 274 logs, about 60 feet long, that will come up to the site.
The Forest Service is now partnering with the Sitka Conservation Society, Trout Unlimited, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to restore the Sitka River. in part by building structures that will mimic the natural processes of an old-growth forest.
Large wood structures will go in on the banks and in the stream to create pool habitat for fish.
Edwards says the Tongass would eventually repair itself, but this project will accelerate that.
We can speed up the forest evolution from something that may take 300 years to get old-growth characteristics to maybe, say, 90 to 100 years to get some of those old-growth characteristics.
The restoration represents a dovetailing of interests for the Forest Service and the Sitka Conservation Society, who have not always seen eye to eye. Now the two groups collaborate closely on some projects, and the SCS is pushing the Forest Service to shift priorities on the Tongass and manage the forest for salmon, not timber.
It's a cultural shift for the Forest Service, and it's something different than the legacy of their organization.
Andrew Tomes is the executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society.
Little by little, the agency is getting their head around the fact that one of the most important commodities and products and environmental services that comes out of the Tongass National Forest is salmon. And that investing in projects like this that restore salmon habitat is economically and socially beneficial for all the communities that live in the region.
The Forest Service may not be moving as fast as SCS would like, but it's in the midst of its own transition. Wayne Owen is the Forest Service Alaska Director for Wildlife, Fisheries, Ecology, and Watersheds.
The Forest Service is trying to broaden the economic base of Southeast Alaska, and timber is an important part of that.
Owen says that under the Obama administration, the agency has committed to restoration projects like this one, and is moving from a single-minded focus on old-growth harvest to a larger agenda.
Fish is the lifeblood, the economic base of the Alaska, Southeast Alaska. I like to tell people that Southeast Alaska is the fish basket of North America.
The Sitka River Project fits neatly within that agenda. So in early June, the Forest Service flew a bunch of reporters in from Juneau to show off their work. The timing was lucky. The contractors cut off the water flow midday with a giant aqua dam, basically a long water-filled bladder that stretches across the river. The dam does its job well. Pretty soon, the water level downstream is dropping fast. Here's what the stream sounded like before the dam. And here's what it sounds like after. So it's time to catch those fish and move them downstream.
Toho, toho. Coho, coho.
The final count was 653. And if the project goes well, a decade from now, there will be many more fish in this river. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Fresh fish?
Ooh, that's a lot of fish.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.